You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 20th, 2009, and this is episode number 200.
Yay!
200.
Don't you love the odometer effect?
And this is your host, Stephen Novella, and joining me this week, as always, is Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
And hello. 200. It's incredible.
Evan, what the hell? That was so cheesy.
It was pretty cheesy.
And hello.
I felt like you just opened up a hotel room holding a glass of cheap champagne.
Steve will fix it in post-production. Steve, you have a de-cheesy button, right?
De-cheesify that.
There's a de-fromage filter.
All right, so what's happening? Is this a podcast? What are we doing here?
I think it is. It's our 200th.
Oh, it is our 200th. I mean, it was May 4th in which we of 2005 in which we actually recorded our very first episode. And we just celebrated that a couple weeks ago. And it so happens around the same time as now our 200th episode. So it's a series of celebrations this month.
We're always just looking for a reason to party.
Absolutely.
Did anything else happen, though, this time?
Oh, well, yes, actually. Okay, so here's something funny that happened, kind of. In 1921, Marie Curie, you remember her?
She was hilarious.
She was presented with a gram of radium worth $100,000 at the White House in Washington, D.C.
Which promptly gave her cancer.
It's about the most interesting thing I could find today, as far as science goes.
That was it. She was presented with the radium.
She was presented with a gram of radium.
Well, what can you do with radium? What would be the things you'd use it for?
Ruining film.
Yeah, destroying your enemies. There's a lot you can do with it.
Marie Curie discovered radioactivity.
The hard way.
Was she awarded the Nobel Prize for that?
Marie Curie won two Nobel Prizes, one in physics in 1903 and one in chemistry in 1911. She is the first person to have won two Nobel Prizes. And she was awesome.
She was. And in a time in which, you know, women could not even vote. So that was pretty impressive.
Yeah. I feel like there was a big announcement this week. Google's homepage is telling me that there was something going on.
Something about a missing link. You know, these things come out every other week.
Yeah.
This was the big news item of the week. Scientists have unveiled. This is a fossil that was actually discovered a number of years ago. I think it's been sitting around in somebody's
like
private condition
for
like 24, 25 years. And then it came to the attention of scientists about 2 years ago who have been studying this fossil, and now they're unveiling the fossil and their initial findings. This is a fossil of a transitional species, what is alleged to be a transitional species between prosimians, which are the earliest primates, and the other branch of primates, which led to monkeys, apes, and humans. This, again, dates to about 47 million years ago. This species makes a connection between these two major branches of primates. And one of the remarkable features of this particular specimen is that it is over 95% complete. It is a remarkably complete specimen, beautifully preserved. One of those specimens that you fell to the bottom of a lake, probably died in the mud, and then was soon covered by layers of mud and was perfectly preserved in that fashion. In fact, it's one of the rare specimens that where you could still see the impression of the fur of the animal.
That's so cool.
It is extremely cool.
Although, of course, you know, if you were to ask answers in Genesis about this, they would tell you that it's so remarkably well preserved because it was buried during the flood.
Right. Of course it was buried during
the flood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the flood. The flood that occurred 57 million years ago, I guess.
6,000 years ago?
Wouldn't they have, wouldn't What's-His-Face have collected two of those creatures? And
yeah, where's the boy?
That would be Noah, not What's-His-Face.
Yeah, whatever.
What's-His-Face, yeah.
Yeah. You know, what's his Bible?
As interesting as this fossil is, of course, we're also interested in the way these news stories are reported, and this one has been all over the map. The first news story I saw on this was from Sky News.
Yeah.
And this is just about the worst science news reporting I have seen in a while. I know we criticize the way the mainstream media presents science stories a lot on this podcast, and there are good there's good reporting and there's bad reporting often on issues. This was the worst. They crammed about as many misconceptions into their story as possible. In addition to that, it seems to me as if the scientists themselves who were unveiling this fossil were engaging in a lot of hype and hyperbole. You know, you always wonder, were they being quoted out of context? You know, were they being treated fairly? But even allowing for a little bit of that, they just, you know, the sound bites that they were offering up to the press, you know, to me were irresponsible. So this fossil, which is dubbed Ida, I-D-A, after the daughter of one of the researchers. One of the experts is quoted as saying that this is the eighth wonder of the world. Said the impact on paleontology will be something like an asteroid falling down to Earth. So, not quite. You know, first, let's have the scientific community take a look at this fossil and see what it really means. But then, in Sky News, this is what they say about it. Researchers say proof of this transitional species finally confirms Charles Darwin's theory of evolution.
Oh, my God.
Finally.
Finally. We've been
all that
waiting.
Other stuff, it was just speculation and theory and conjecture.
Yeah, we don't even know where Darwin came up with that crap. Surely he didn't have evidence.
There was nothing before this.
There is a tendency in reporting new and interesting findings. And sometimes the scientists do this themselves, sometimes it's their press office, sometimes, but often the media, to overemphasize the previous state of our ignorance, right? So they want to say, we knew nothing, but now this discovery changes everything. Yeah. That's always how they want to couch it. But in so doing, they really completely misrepresent the current state of knowledge. Come on. Yeah. This one fossil confirms Darwin's theory of evolution? Please.
Yeah, I mean, there are a million biologists slapping their foreheads like, oh, well, just forget about all that work we've been doing. This is it.
Yeah. They're treating it like a paradigm shift.
You know, and that one fossil would also disprove all of intelligent design and everything. Like, you know, they're putting so much weight on this one thing. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. It's counterproductive. Here's another misconception that it seems as if the scientists themselves were promoting to the media, because there's at least quote marks around these statements.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing is that the scientists waited for 2 years to present this, and there's already a documentary starring Sir David Attenborough about this fossil. And so some of these quotes are from David Attenborough, who said, "This little creature is going to show us our connection with the rest of the mammals." This is the one that connects us directly with them.
Also, you know, that quote could have easily been taken out of context. If it comes from the documentary they've been doing, it might have just been used as an introduction. Like, we're going to use this piece to show you exactly how we're connected to the rest of the mammals.
I said, yes, you know, all the usual comments. But here's the other quote she gives. "The link they would have said up to now is missing. Well, it's no longer missing," referring to the link between humans and the rest of the animal kingdom. Mm. So here's another trend in reporting fossils. Whatever connection can be made to humanity is always overemphasized as well. This is a link between the two earliest branches within primates, prosimians and then the monkeys, apes, and hominids. But it's not the link that connects the human branch to the rest of primates, any more than it's a link between apes and primates, you know what I mean? That's completely the wrong context. This is 40 million years in the past of humans branching off from the rest of primates or the rest of mammals. I mean, it just is nonsensical. I'm not even sure what they're trying to convey there, except trying to make it seem like this has some very direct and specific implications for human evolution, which it really doesn't.
It doesn't.
That it's a primate.
How many similar other branchings happened in the past?
Right.
That are just as cool as this one. I mean, it's not unique in that regard.
Right.
But Steve, real quick, you mentioned the movie with Attenborough and stuff, but you're only really scratching the surface at the level of this coordinated event.
Yeah, go ahead.
Between the scientists and the History Channel. There was the unveiling at the American Museum of Natural History. There was a publishing of a peer-reviewed article of the film like that you mentioned, going into detail about the secret of 2 years study of the fossil, a book release, an exclusive arrangement with ABC News, and an elaborate website, all, you know, orchestrated by the History Channel and these scientists. And regarding this, the scientist at the University of Oslo, one of the guys who kind of put all this team together, he said any pop band is doing the same thing. Any athlete is doing the same thing. We have to start thinking the same way in science.
But it's really diluting the science, I think.
But is there a point to be made in there, though, that scientists do have to think about the perception and how to get the word out about scientific discoveries? I mean, obviously, things have gone terribly wrong in this case when it comes to some of the news that's being reported. But at its heart, you know, I can certainly understand the sentiment of wanting your work recognized and wanting to reach out to a mainstream audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Just don't distort the science while you're in the process,
yeah.
That's all.
That's true, but there's another factor. There's another point to this, and this isn't really just a couple guys that were looking at this fossil for the past couple of years. This is an international team of scientists that have been vetting this fossil for all this time. So to me, that gives it maybe a little bit more credence in that it's a pretty big team of pretty good scientists that already have checked this out for 2 years.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's not like Hans and Fleischmann that got some, you
Hans,
know,
energy. Pons and Fleischer.
I'm sorry.
Hans
and Franz.
Hans and Franz.
It's not like Pons and Fleischmann who got to get a little extra heat coming out and like, oh, we got cold fusion. It's been vetted for quite a while. So
yeah, it's a legitimate fossil. I'm sure it's going to have a very significant implications in terms of our understanding of primate evolution. It is a quote-unquote missing link, although that term is misleading and we should really try to get away from it. It is a transitional species, clearly. It's also the researchers acknowledge it's probably not a direct ancestor. So again, not the grandmother, but the great aunt. As we say.
Right, I like that.
So they acknowledge that. But the hype was so disgusting that and the distortion, again, downplaying what we already know about evolution, for example, as well as saying, like, this is the most significant transitional specimen ever found, whereas other scientists are like, it's nice, but it's no Archaeopteryx. This is no feathered dinosaur. I mean, come on. Let's put things in perspective.
Yeah.
We have lots of other fossils that are more significant in terms of their implications as a transitional species.
You know, what's ironic about this is that we, in the big scheme of things, you know, any news that supports evolution is fantastic in a way, but we're also skeptics. We're also sticklers for information not only being correct, but we also want the information explained properly.
Yeah.
If we were creationists, we would be jumping all over this, exploiting it to the nth degree. But here we are on our podcast criticizing something that we should most people would just say, yeah, that's great. It's a good article.
Right.
You know, but we're here criticizing it because it wasn't even presented correctly.
That distorted the science. It distorted the truth. They're treating it like a paradigm shift. It is merely another piece of the puzzle that was predicted that we would eventually find.
Yeah, you shouldn't make the science enthusiasts cringe, right? Yes, you want to reach out to the public where it's just one other piece of news in the news cycle and may not have a pre-existing deep interest in science. And you can make it sexy, you can make it interesting, but if you do it in a way that makes anybody who knows what they're talking about, again, do the facepalm and cringe, you failed. I mean, you made some major mistakes if you've done that. And I think this is contributing to I think they contributed to the public misunderstanding of this science. Jay, the creationists, like, again, my favorite evolution news and views, the Discovery Institute, propaganda blog. Of course, they did jump all over the media circus surrounding this fossil. They obviously have nothing significant to say about the science. This is a transitional species, beautifully preserved, well dated, rigorously examined scientifically. It fills in, yes, it does fill in a piece of the puzzle in terms of the history of evolution on the Earth, but they'd open the door to criticizing the media hype and ascribing it to quote unquote those Darwinists, right? Whereas we're sitting here saying, the news media and these irresponsible scientists are presenting this with inappropriate hype, but they're criticizing the same things we're criticizing, but attaching it to those Darwinists as if we're trying to pull one over on the public by deceiving them about the implications of this fossil. So when you're dealing with evolution, and the presentation of evolution to the public, if you do that and you have no recognition that half of the public doesn't believe in evolution and that there are dedicated critics out there, I mean, that's just incredibly naive. You have to, you know, every statement you say, every soundbite you hand the media has to be done very deliberately with the knowledge that this is a controversial subject about which the public is profoundly confused, which has extreme ideological enemies. And if you just ignore that, you know, you're going to be just handing gifts to the anti-scientific side of this equation, right?
It just shows how they're just not on their radar, it seems, right? They're not even thinking about it.
It's terrible. It's like that guy we were talking about, the other scientist, about the Cambrian explosion, talking about it as if these fossils just like appeared out of a magic box.
Right. Oh, you
know,
God.
You just can't say things like that. You know, it's just... but it's misleading and it's wrong, first of all.
Really?
But
it's
hyperbole that is just a gift wrapped for the critics of evolution, you know. But some media outlets did get it right. The BBC article in particular was very good.
I heard that my GPS system is going to explode. Oh noes, what do I do?
Well, let's talk about it then.
We love our acronyms. ATM, IBM, laser, FUBAR, it's one of my favorites. Here's one that's WTF, pretty much indispensable. BPQ. GPS, I'm sure you guys have all heard of GPS. Don't even need to say what it means, right?
They ship anywhere. O-N-G. Oh, wait, that's you.
Global Positioning System. So I was pretty shocked then when I ran across headlines like these today, a world without GPS, unthinkable. GPS, GPS on verge of breakdown, report finds. So needless to say, I had to find out what the hubbub was about. It turns out the U.S. Government Accountability Office, I mean, imagine, don't they sound, you don't want them breathing down your back, right? The U.S. Government Accountability Office.
Do we have one of those? Seriously? I can't believe that our government is accountable for anything.
Yeah, right.
That's a very good point, Rebecca.
What have they been doing the past 10 years?
they've been looking at GPS, I guess. They're basically a government watchdog agency, as you might have surmised. They recently warned Congress that because of poor management with a $2 billion upgrade, it's actually going to threaten the GPS service.
The upgrade is going to threaten it?
Well, the upgrade is a $2 billion upgrade program that's being worked on. That's actually threatening the GPS service. Now, from the report, I read the summary of the report, and what they're saying is that the oldest satellites that comprise the GPS system they're going to start dying, quote unquote, next year, and replacements are not going to be ready.
What?
Right. That's what they're saying. And it's because of two reasons, basically. There's technical problems, as you might imagine. I guess it's pretty complicated to put this stuff together. And they're having troubles with a contractor. I think they got a new contractor and they're having some trouble with this firm or whatever it is. So the result has been an $870 million cost overrun.
What?
You know,
oh yeah,
sound like a lot of money.
Yeah, let's just overrun by almost half the amount of money that it was costing.
Yeah, right.
I mean, who cares? Like, you know, is this really a life or death situation? Are we going to freak out because we might have to go back to, you know, using primitive tools like maps and stopping at the gas station to ask for directions?
Yeah, obviously, Rebecca, you don't understand the implications.
No,
what she just told the world was that she doesn't have a GPS system, because if you did,
where am I going to put a GPS on my bike?
You want a guy to pull over and talk to somebody rather than use a gadget to know where they're going?
Well, I think clearly I need to do a little bit of background of exactly what GPS is and what it does for
All
us.
All right, but make it clear.
Stop. Everybody knows what the hell it is and what it does for us.
Yeah, you stick it in your car and it drives you around Boston and gets you lost.
The details are interesting. Our GPS is the only fully functional global navigation satellite system in the world. Becoming fully operational
fully
in 1995. The Russians actually had one. I wasn't aware of this. The Russians had a global navigation satellite system, but because of all the economic problems they were going through, it totally went into disrepair, and now it's essentially unusable. So they actually have the satellites up there enough to cover the globe, but it's actually just kind of, you know, they're just limping along and not doing what they need to do. So, and there are other countries, actually. China is working on one that's global, and the European Union actually is going to have one that's going to come online in 2013. The Russian one might be back online in 2010. They're predicting it might come back online, although I don't know if it can interface with our system. So these satellites, there's a constellation. They call these constellations of satellites. They're in orbit, in medium Earth orbit, around the Earth. 1,000 to 22,000 miles up is this area called medium Earth orbit. And we've got about 31 or 32 satellites, depending on who you talk to about this. And
is one Pluto?
I say 31. I say 32.
So, Rebecca, so what this thing, this isn't just, you know, navigation on your iPhone or your car navigator. This is map making, land surveying, commerce, geocaching, geoshagging.
Geoshagging? Is that like geocaching but with sex?
You got it. And not to mention all the military uses. So this technology is just ubiquitous.
Meh.
And if we lost it, it would impact national security. So this is a big deal if this is true. All right, so what are the symptoms? Say worst case scenario, and this report is correct, and we start getting these GPS brownouts.
What's failing about these satellites? Because they seem to be so high up. It's not like their orbit's decaying or anything, right? They're just running out of juice or just – what's going on?
These satellites have a lifespan. When they go up, they say this satellite is going to last for so many years. That's how long the productive life is. And that kind of keys into why I don't think that this is going to be much of a problem, because the expected lifespan is not necessarily the actual lifespan, especially for military space equipment. They last longer. I mean, look at these probes we send look at the probes we send to Mars. They say, well, we're going to use this thing for 6 months, and then 30 years later, this thing's still kicking around. I mean, these things they last longer. So this is not hard and fast. It's not like these birds are going to drop out of the sky.
Bob, you know, we have to kind of also trust the experts. You know, these are people that understand the technology, understand the hardware, and if they say that things could start potentially be breaking down as early as next year, I mean, I would tend to agree with them and not go on what you
said. No, it could. It definitely could, but one satellite's not going to do it. We only need a minimum of 24 satellites, and we have 31. So what are the odds of 7 of them failing before replacements start getting into orbit? It doesn't sound urgent to me. It's something that we should be looking into. But don't forget, Jay, that GPS is so important that if the shit really started hitting the fan and this is starting to look nasty, our government would do pretty much exactly what is needed. They would throw money at this, whatever was needed, to get
billions.
This stuff fixed.
Aren't we
no
at that
way,
point right now?
There's
I mean,
no
if
way.
It is as serious as you say.
No, he's saying that it's not serious.
Look at the worst symptoms that I was able to find regarding this. It's going to take longer for your computer to compute your location.
No.
So you wait a few more seconds, and then it'll be a little bit worse in areas that have poor sky views. Like, say, they call these downtown canyons. Like, you're between all these buildings or you're inside buildings. It's going to take a little bit longer. The military applications will be worse because they rely on much more precise precise locations that it would be a little tougher for them. But the consumers would barely see this, I think, at least initially. It would take – it's not like your navigator is going to take an hour to find out where you are and make it unusable.
Well, so for everybody's sake, I hope that they figure out what's going on. They mop this thing up quick, and no, there'll be no disturbance for the military or for the fact that I love my Garmin. So there it is.
It's just a matter of getting satellites up to replace the ones that are failing.
Yeah, you got to build the satellites, guys. And if the contractor's screwing up, they don't have the satellites ready to launch. I mean, that's what it probably boils down to.
But there's a workaround, though. We've got these other global systems coming online in the next 4 or 5 years, and they are specifically being designed to interface with GPS. So they'll augment each other and help each other. So you'll be able to kind of like fuse these global navigation satellite systems together with, say, the Galileo one in the European Union or GLONASS perhaps. So they'll help each other's reliability and their accuracy. And don't forget, worst case scenario, all we got to do is tap into the alien satellites and use their network, and we could probably be accurate to within one angstrom.
Perfect.
Right.
Okay.
So bottom line, don't panic. Okay. Next.
Well, stem cells have been in the news again. I know we've actually spoken before about the fact that there are many clinics throughout the world, especially in China, selling stem cell therapy, usually for something on the order of $20,000 per treatment. And there's another clinic out there that's been getting a lot of news in the East, this Beaker Biotech Clinic in Northeast China. And same deal, they're making claims that for amazing clinical therapeutic effects, but they're not publishing any science. Nobody knows what they're actually injecting into people. And the bottom line is that while the potential for stem cell research is tremendous, I mean, I think stem cells, you know, there's a tremendous potential there to be very effective therapies for a lot of things in 5 to 20 years. There really isn't anything right now that's available. That's available clinically. There are, you know, there's clinical research going on, et cetera. But
so these guys basically are like, they sound no better than faith healers or anybody selling miracle cures to desperate people.
That's basically it, at, you know, really incredible prices. So unfortunately, they've been very successful in getting their stories told in Western media. And even when the Western media tries to be responsible and does a reasonable job at covering the story, the bottom line is, it's still, to people who are sick or to parents, they're only going to see the story that they wrap, the personal anecdote that they wrap the story around. So unfortunately, that's what they did in this case. This is a BBC reporting on this. And again, generally, BBC does a great job with these science stories. But they tell the story of a three-year-old girl named Dakota whose parents spent £30,000 to bring her to this, you know, Beaker Biotech clinic to treat her blindness.
It's incredibly sad because
it is very sad.
And you know, like you said, just by publishing the information, it somehow does make it worse. And in this case, the mother specifically said that basically the doctors told them, don't bother going online just to find some crazy out there cure because they're not going to work. And that's exactly what she did. She went online. She searched until she found something that offered a glimmer of hope to give her child sight back and went for it. And it's, you know, the result is that she brings the kid back and they test the kid and she still doesn't have any sight. Yet the mother says she does. It's
right.
She wants to believe it so badly that she's thinking that her daughter can see now, despite the fact that she obviously cannot.
The parents, confident in the therapy, agreed to have the child's vision tested, and it showed zero difference before and after the therapy. But the mother is quoted as saying, "If a specialist wants to argue the point, come and watch my child and tell me that the child isn't seeing anything and that it never made a difference." Very sad. This is, you know, typical of cons, actually, that, you know, people would rather believe that they made the right decision and not admit that they were victimized, right? And this is especially true when, and in this case, I've actually personally seen this exact scenario play out. You have a parent taking care of a sick child. They want to do everything possible. There's this miracle cure that's being dangled before them. They can't afford the incredibly ridiculous price tag. So what do? They have a fundraiser among all their friends and their neighborhood and their family. Everyone gets together, raises a lot of money so that they can hand it over to some quack selling a false hope.
Yeah.
And then the treatment doesn't work, but the parents, there's just at that point, there's almost no way psychologically they're going to be able to admit that there was no effect. So they look for anything, you know, the confirmation bias to convince themselves that there was some effect.
And of course, this case is bad, but at least it's not the worst case in which the kid is, for instance, on chemo, but is taken off it so that they can fly him across, you know, the world so he can get some quack treatment and ends up causing more damage. In this case, it looks like they've only lost, you know, a great deal of money and spent a lot of a lot of time for nothing. But
right, and you know, of course, when they're confronted by the media, the people who are part of this clinic, about what they're doing. They say, oh, well, scientists in the West don't pay attention to Chinese scientists, and we're publishing in Chinese journals, and they don't know what we're doing. But that's BS. That's just not true. They're not publishing any scientific results, other than sometimes maybe some case series, which is essentially that just their own anecdotal experience.
I guess they don't want American money either.
Well, they're getting the American money, right?
But not in the quantities they would get it if they actually marketed this successfully in the United States. If it actually worked, that'd be a great motivator to go everywhere, not be isolated where you are, but it spread it all over the world.
The thing is, science has to be transparent, right? And in medicine, it's the same way. If there's one clinic in the world doing something, it's almost guaranteed that it's fake, that it's a con job. The only possible exception to that is if you have a particularly, gifted surgeon who personally perfected a new surgical technique, and therefore that's the only guy at the moment or only woman who has the technical skill and knowledge to do a new surgical technique. So in that case, it's actually plausible that there may only be one center that can do it. But if it's just a therapy, if it's a drug or stem cells or whatever, if the science is there, then there will be hundreds, if not thousands, of institutions around the world that will be able to do it, right? In this case, the science just isn't there. There are tons of technical problems that have yet to be worked out in the stem cell technology, and they're not just saying that they've made one or two steps in stem cell therapy. If their clinical claims are true, then they've made a dozen or 20 steps, and they're 10 to 20 years ahead of the rest of the world, and they have nothing to show for it. That just is beyond credibility, unfortunately. But people will read even a skeptical article, and they will see these parents believe their 3-year-old girl was helped. That's enough for me. That's enough of a desperate hope. From their perspective, it's not even unreasonable. If you're facing a death sentence from an incurable disease, even a thin hope might be rational. You really can't put it on the patient or on a family, parents of a sick child. Very sad, but this is not going to go away anytime soon, unfortunately.
This is James Randi, and you're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Let's do a couple of emails this week.
Let's do that.
First email comes from Eddie G. from St. Louis.
Steve.
You have to say it like this. Eddie G.
And Eddie, reminds you of Meal G. Remember him, Meal G?
Oh,
yeah. Meatleg.
Meatleg.
Neil Gaiman. Oh, right.
Eddie writes, several years ago, a coworker brought an article to my attention in an issue of Maxim referring to the fish feared by all men of the Amazon for its tendency to follow the flow of urine and swim up the human male urethra, thereby lodging itself and being nearly impossible to remove. He was convinced it had to be true. Why else would Maxim print it? I had my doubts. To me, it all sounded like the kind of nonsense Taylor made to strike fear in the heart and other dearer parts of a Maxim subscriber. I noted it made no mention of the fish being attracted to women or other mammals for that matter, merely to urine produced by human males. The article went so far as to imply this was a stage of the catfish's life cycle. Since then, this fish story has reemerged over and over again, but my attempts to find any information on it haven't been terribly successful. Mostly it sounds like an urban legend, but I was wondering if you had any insights.
Okay, first of all, can we address the idea that why else would Maxim print it? People, let's not go to Maxim for our science, okay? Whether this turns out to be right or wrong, how to get in her pants is not, that's not news, and it's not logical. It's just put down the magazine. Stop buying that.
But it is important.
It's so not important. I mean, really, Maxim, come on.
Yeah, that's a separate issue, and you're absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely.
I read it for the technical articles myself.
Shut.
What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, just get the porn.
What do you guys think? Does a fish swim up the stream of urine into the end of the penis and lodge itself in the urethra?
Yes.
What is it, science or fiction? How long does it stay a stream? I mean, it's totally getting attenuated, probably, an inch or two from the end.
I would say that, yes, that creature exists. That's my guess.
Well, the Candiru exists. The question is whether or not it actually does that.
I say it does that.
So, kind of. I mean, I was actually surprised at how true this is.
Well, how maybe true this is.
Yeah, there are pictures.
Cecil covered this on Straight Dope, which is what you're going to bring up, right? Uncle Cecil, who we all know and love and trust. And, you know, he had originally posted that, you know, that it doesn't exist, that it's an urban legend, or that he was at least very skeptical of whether or not it does exist. But then the study came up, or this case study came up, in which a doctor claims to have discovered this very thing. And I don't know, Steve, do you want to address this case study?
Yeah, so there's a published, or at least a presented case study, where a man claims to have been standing in a river in the Amazon, and up to his thighs, and peeing in the river, and that about a 2-inch long fish jumped out of the water and into his urethra. He basically latched on and then sort of squiggled his way in there. Now, so it didn't swim up the stream of his urine, right? So that part was embellishment, at least if you're taking this story at face value. So there doesn't seem to be any support for the notion that it's like swimming up the urine stream, or even really that it's attracted to urine, or that urine has anything to do with this at all. What this fish does do, though, is this fish is a parasite, and it crawls inside of animals. It will find any orifice, work its way inside, and then, you know, eat and reproduce on the inside of an animal. That is the life cycle of this case. But this is an individual case where I guess the fish was looking for an orifice, and there was one, so it jumped in. The man eventually presented to medical care, and a urologist actually endoscopically removed the dead fish from inside his scrotum. What I could say is, this doesn't mean that this is a true case, but what I could say is, you know, the doctors are named, which is always a good point. You know, it makes a story more credible when you actually have the individuals referred to by name. And the description of the medical procedure sounded completely kosher to me. It made sense, and it sounded like an actual medical description of a procedure. So it didn't have the red flags of this is somebody making up a fake medical story to make it sound legitimate. You know what I mean?
Oh, but can I? Yeah, there is. I agree with you on this point. However, I do think that the doctors sound very legit, and Cecil says he talked to one of the doctors that was involved, and it all sounds like it's on the up and up. But what the doctors know is that there was a fish inside this man's urethra and that they removed it.
Right.
What they're taking on faith is the man's story.
Is how it got there, right.
Yes. And I feel that in this case, Cecil was not skeptical enough of the story, because there are other ways for objects to become lodged in a penis.
Right.
You would know this.
I know this because I have access to the internet. And
that's the only way that you know.
And as we all know, if there's something pervy out there that has been thought of, then someone has done it and uploaded it to the internet. And, you know, there is a certain fetish that involves sticking things in your penis. And
oh, come on. Really? We're not going to talk about this.
Well, no, I think that this is a legitimate issue. It's very, you know, common that people get things stuck inside them and have to go to the emergency room to have it
removed.
That's
true, but are you going to put a carnivorous parasite in there? I mean, come on.
Hey, it might not be my thing.
Talk about poor judgment.
Steve, they put hamsters
up there.
Hamsters aren't known for eating animals from the inside out.
I'm not saying that this is necessarily what happened. I'm just saying that there are other explanations.
Here's my hypothesis, is that that the guy was submerged from the waist down at some point, and the thing crawled in there, because that's what it does. Yeah. You know, jumping out of the water is not that, you know, by his description, you imagine he's up to his thighs. You know, that's pretty much right there. It's not like it would have had to have gone very far. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So The bit that always seemed the most extraordinary to me was the actually swimming up the stream of the urine. That always seemed ridiculous, and I think we could safely remove that element from the story.
Yeah, I thought he meant when he was urinating within, you know, waist deep and following the stream. That I didn't know you meant the stream was outside the water.
Yeah, that's clear, but
you kind of had to draw your own.
Well, that's the urban legend is like you imagine somebody standing on the shore and the fish swimming up the
ocean. Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's cool.
I've heard sharks can do that too.
Right, that's just the embellishment
swim
of the story.
Up your stream and eat you.
Right. So yeah, and the other bit that sounds reasonable is that you know the fish normally you know is not a parasite on humans. Does not normally crawl in the urethra. It does, though, however, just find its way inside mammals and is a parasite from the inside. And that this is just an accidental thing that happens rarely. There were reports of like finding a dead mammal in a river, and you cut it open, and these things spill out of it, you know, because they were basically feasting from the inside.
Well, now that our male audience has completely torn off all their headphones and thrown away their iPods, should we continue?
Yeah, but it's interesting because this is more true than I thought it was going to be when I first, you know, read the story, you know? It's interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm. All right, so the bottom line is that, indeed, this thing will crawl up your Willy Wonka.
If it can get there, yeah.
Did you just say your Willy Wonka? It's just wrong.
Don't swim naked in the Amazon. That's the lesson.
All right. Great advice.
Man, if only I'd learned that sooner.
That's a safety tip. I think what we need to do is a safety tip each week.
Oh, tip of the week, right.
Safety tip of the week.
Steve, we're going to give those kind of safety tips, like don't set yourself on fire, don't let fish swim up your...
Exactly. As a public service announcement.
Don't chop off your arm with a machete.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Right? Don't eat uranium.
don't take silver colloidal medicine.
Don't drink silver. You're right. Stuff like that.
Things they don't tell you about in school.
Don't put monkeys in your pants.
Or birds in your pants. Right, exactly. All right, let's go on to one more email. This one comes from the pronunciation guide is almost as bad as the word. Why
it's Lasse.
Lasse Maruin. But why give a pronunciation guide that has R-E-U-X in it?
Yeah, why?
I mean, come on. All right, Lasse Maruin. This one comes from Lasse Maruin, and they write, I understand that you do all this show on your free time and that your expenses are covered by donations. So I wonder, what would you do with...
$1 million.
$1 million. What would we do with $1 million?
More seriously, what would you do if somebody donated huge amounts of cash to the SGU? Would you do more shows? Quit your day jobs? Hire people to help with production? Spend it all on one huge party? I wish to stress that I am not a crazy rich person. But you never know. There might be somebody listening, so keep that in mind when you discuss this. Thanks for the great show.
We always keep that
solid
in
gold rocket bike.
Right. Honestly, I've never thought about this. What would we do?
200,000 transcripts of Nightline. That's what I would buy. $5 each.
I'd quit my job, yes, in an instant, and I would do an SGU every day.
Yeah, well, we wouldn't do one every day. I mean, if we had enough money to really do this full time, I mean, I think we would reasonably say we'd do 3 a week, and we'd produce other content, too. I mean, let's face it, we do have a ton of ideas.
Yeah.
Some of which we may be executing right now, which is a secret.
Ton of ideas, not a ton of time.
I would, you know what I would do? I would stop looking for work.
Seriously, my job takes up, you know, like 12 hours of my day every day. If I could get those 12 hours back, think of how awesome I would be.
Right.
I'd be twice as awesome.
It would be nice if we could all have professional careers. And what I mean by professional is we get paid for it.
For
careers
doing
in skepticism. That would be really nice. It would take more than $1 million, though, to get us all,
not me,
you know, full-time working in the field of skepticism and make a living for our families and so forth.
Not for me. I'm cheap. I'm very cheap. just going to put that out there. I don't mean that in a sexy way. I just mean I am literally inexpensive.
There are different answers depending on exactly the level of cash that you're talking about. And we would upscale what we do to meet really almost any amount of money that somebody would throw our way. So absolutely we would hire people to do things that right now we're slumming for volunteers to do, right? We could hire people to do the website full time, hire people to do post production. You know, we would, you know, obviously get
clip
better equipment.
Jay's toenails.
Right. We could hire people to do video production. We could basically have a skeptical studio where we produce all skeptical content, not only our own. I mean, you can just keep scaling this up, a video production company, et cetera.
An official skeptical pony.
Skeptical pony.
Right.
But most importantly, though, I mean, what would we do? We would attend every event that we could.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
There's just so many other things that we could spend time doing. That would be adding to our content, you know.
Right.
Steve has been begging me not to say anything, but we have some secret stuff that we're working on right now that we could do a lot more of.
We're hoping to have some of it ready for TAM 7. I'd like to have it actual ready before I promise it, but you know, there may be.
And speaking of, more live shows.
As long as we're
more
dreaming
live shows,
right now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, more conferences. You know, absolutely. There's so much actual marketing. Can you imagine?
Yeah, real marketing is what we really need.
See, obviously we're not waiting around for somebody like Bill Gates to drop $10 million on us. So that would be nice. Mm. If you're listening, Bill.
Yeah, Bill.
But we certainly would put it to good use. I would also point out that the other side, and on almost every issue that we cover, has millions of dollars. I mean, it's incredible.
Billions.
The Discovery Institute has millions of dollars. Those jackasses at Age of Autism, they make $400,000 a year that
Kevin
they spend
Trudeau.
Marketing misinformation about vaccines. And here we are doing it for free in our spare time, trying to counteract all of these things. It's incredible.
Just look at Kevin Trudeau, the one-man band. Look what he did.
Yeah. There's millions of dollars to be made on the other side. That's unfortunately the case. Wherein, mm-hmm. as you say, as we've proven, there's no money in skepticism. But so we had a minor correction or clarification from last week, Bob, on your piece about heavy water and the ultra-dense deuterium.
Yeah, a lot of people pointed out correctly that the heavy water ice would not, in fact, sink if our oceans were made of heavy water. It would not sink because even though the heavy water ice is denser than regular water ice, it's not denser than heavy water itself. So it would, in fact, float as well. What I should have said was that if water, if H2O didn't have that bizarre property that it does not get denser when it freezes, like most other elements, that it would, it would do that. It would not float. The ice would not float. It would freeze from the bottom up. But luckily, it has that unusual property, and because life, I think, would be very different.
Right.
If it didn't.
That's right. So regular water, H2O, does get denser as it cools down to about 4 degrees Celsius, and then it actually gets lighter. And ice is actually lighter than water, so it floats on the surface. So water freezes from the top down rather than the bottom up. And the bottom of oceans is typically always exactly 4 degrees Celsius, because that's where what the densest water is going to be. Whereas deuterium water, D2O, I think it becomes densest at around 6 to 7 degrees, and then it gets lighter again.
Right.
But, so deuterium ice would sink in regular water, but it would still flow in deuterium water, is the bottom line.
Right.
So we wanted to just clarify that one point.
And thanks for everybody for pointing that out.
Yeah, thanks to all 1 million of you who wrote in to tell us about that.
Well,
let's go on to science fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready?
So ready.
Well met.
Here we go, item number 1. Scientists have developed a new dating technique for ceramics and pottery that involves measuring its water content with a microscale capable of detecting 1/10 of a millionth of a gram. Item number 2, neuroscientists mapping brain networks find that children younger than 12 have disorganized and chaotic brain function. And item number 3, new research finds that attaining goals of fame, fortune, and good looks are associated with less, not more, happiness. Bob, go first.
A dating technique, ceramics and pottery that involves measuring its water content with a microscale
capable of detecting 1/10 of a millionth of a gram. It's not much water. A micro scale, I guess the micro scale isn't what I think it is, but I mean, that sounds interesting, and nothing's jumping out at me on that one. What is it assuming now, that the amount of water content changes over time, so therefore they can determine how old it is, I guess. I don't know. Let's see the second one here. Neuroscientists mapping brain networks find that children younger than 12 have disorganized and chaotic brain function. Disorganized and chaotic. Sounds possible. As the brain matures, it gets more organized and less chaotic, I guess. Let's look at number three then. Attaining goals of fame, fortune, and good looks are associated with less, not more, happiness. That makes perfect sense to me. So few people can attain fame, fortune, and good looks that a lot of people are pretty frustrated and not as happy. So that makes probably the most sense of any of the other ones. So let's see, which of the other ones are less likely then?
Yeah, any moment now. Any moment it's going to happen. I can feel it.
Yeah.
We're getting close.
Any moment. When you say that, it actually slows me down.
Yeah. If you weigh these choices, Bob, and organize your thoughts, I trust you'll be happy.
Disorganized and chaotic brain functions, Bob.
Wouldn't the water content change depending on the environment that it's in? For some reason, number two, I'm going to say the disorganized and chaotic brain function. I'm going to flip a coin and say that one's fiction.
Okay, Jay?
You know, after reading these through, I really think that the second one about the disorganized brain function, that one seems to be the most likely off. That one seems to be most likely the fake. I mean, I can understand the idea of the brain, like, in mid-development and going through changes. It's not only like going through changes, but it's actually growing. You know, the size of the brain is growing and everything. There's got to be something, you know, not completely settled happening in a child's mind. I mean, it's underdeveloped. And with the changes that are taking place over the next, you know, five to ten years, I'm sure that wait a second.
You just said it's fake and then made a case for it being
contradicted
true.
Yourself.
Did you just talk yourself out of it?
All right, you know, the children having disorganized and chaotic brain functions is fake. I think.
Okay,
that's it. Yeah.
All right, Rebecca.
I tend to agree because I can't imagine something as cool and amazing as the brain could ever be called disorganized and chaotic at any time during our lives. It, you know, it forms these pathways like immediately. And I don't know, everything I've ever read about the brain shows that it wouldn't be called that normally. So, and then as for the others, dating ceramics and pottery by measuring its water, that makes sense because I'm thinking of how they come out of the kiln, you know, and then, I can see that the water content would change over time. So, I think that makes sense. And I agree with what Bob said about happiness. Fame and fortune and good looks, they're fleeting and difficult to meet the standards set by our society. So that would cause less happiness. So I'm saying that the second one is, in fact, false. Children younger than 12. Do in fact have organized brain function.
Okay, Evan?
I'll agree with everyone else. Here was my thinking, is that, you know, we think of 12, we think of how young that is and so forth, but, you know, it was only, 100, 150 years ago that people, lived to an average of 40, 45 years old. We're living to 78 nowadays, so we kind of take it for granted. So I would say you pretty much had to have your brain wired up pretty well by then. So that's why I think 2 is fiction.
Okay, so let's take these in order.
Okay.
Number one, scientists have developed a new dating technique for ceramics and pottery that involves measuring its water content with a microscale capable of detecting 1/10 of a millionth of a gram, and that one is science.
Cool.
This one's very cool. Very cool.
So is the microscale so accurate with the weight that it could tell from day to day how the weight is changing?
Not from day to day, no. So this is used to date archaeological finds, and they say that it's accurate for pottery or ceramics that are up to about 2,000 years old, but they think that with some tweaking, they might be able to push that to about 10,000 years old. And what they do, this is called rehydroxylation dating. Rehydroxylation dating. And Rebecca's right, when you fire a brick or a tile or pottery or whatever in the kiln, that sort of resets the clock, right? That bakes out all the water.
Right.
So you know that at the moment of creation, it essentially has no water content because it's all been baked out.
See, I know this because I do a lot of paint-your-own pottery classes.
Is that right?
I thought it was because you shop at Pottery Barn.
That doesn't even make sense.
No, it doesn't. And then water will slowly, slowly, slowly over the years bind with the pottery. So what they do, if they find a little piece of pottery in an archaeological find, they weigh it, they bake out all the water, weigh it again. So now they know how much water was in it. And then in order to calibrate it, they then will observe it over time. And this is where the microscale really comes into play, is they see, all right, now how quickly is it going to accrue water over time? And then they extrapolate from that to the total water content and therefore its total age. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Very much so.
Very cool. Very clever. Very cool.
That is pretty cool.
Now, interestingly, they say that if we know the exact age of a piece of pottery, because from other lines of evidence,
verify it.
Yeah, you could verify. We know this thing was made in 1250 AD, right? For whatever. Then they can, knowing the date, they can use this technique in order to calibrate the rate at which, over historical time, the water would have bound with that piece of pottery. They could say, this is how fast it's binding water now. This is the average rate at which it was binding water over its lifetime. And that may become a way of estimating the average temperature over historical time. Isn't that interesting? So if you know, if you can guess the temperature, you could say, all right, we're gonna basically assume that the current rates are the same as the average rates over historical time and to estimate the age. But if we actually knew the age, then we could use that to estimate the average temperature over the historical time. So this may be another line of evidence to sort of get at the whole question of global warming or climate change. What have temperatures been in the past? Very cool. And of course, archaeologists will love this. I mean, if you thought to date a find, I mean, these kind of bricks and bits of ceramics and clay and whatever are very common in a lot of archaeological finds. This will be a huge boon to archaeology.
Wouldn't the environment be a huge factor in determining how quickly it binds with water?
You mean like, is it buried under the ground versus
right,
laying on the
right.
surface versus under a lake?
Yeah.
I would assume.
So then when they weigh it and then they fire it again and then they see how quickly it binds, they really should be putting it in a similar environment that it was for a majority of its lifetime in order to be apples to apples.
Yeah.
I'm sure they've thought of that, but just wonder how they deal with it.
Yeah, I didn't have access to the technical paper, only the press stories about it, so I couldn't find anything. I thought I had that same thought. I mean, what about the environment? And they didn't mention anything about that. I'm sure they take that into consideration, but that sounds like a variable that might introduce some error.
Next,
neuroscientists mapping brain networks find that children younger than 12 have disorganized and chaotic brain function. Clearly, Rebecca, you don't have kids, right?
Not that she knows of.
Not that she knows of.
I've met some.
You have?
Before. I think once or twice. Hey, I run a magic shop. Come on.
So neuroscientists mapping brain networks find that children younger than 12 have disorganized and chaotic brain function. And this one, you guys all thought was the fiction. Those
we
with
thought.
And without children thought that this one was fiction. And this one is fiction.
Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Just didn't sound.
See, I know kids. I know 12-year-olds.
Yes.
In fact,
to avoid them, right?
I practically am a 12-year-old.
That's true.
Well, goes without saying.
In fact, this was based upon a real story where they did compare the brain mapping of children and adults. The senior author, Stephen Peterson, is quoted as saying, "Regardless of how tempting it might be to assume otherwise, a normal child's brain is not inherently disorganized or chaotic." So it's exactly the opposite of true. But what is true is that kids' brains are organized differently than adults, and they undergo a fairly significant reorganization as they age, as they mature. But they're still organized throughout the whole process. It's just different. And when I mean organized, I mean, you know, there are different parts of the brain, different modules, if you will, that participate in different functions, and they network together in order to perform tasks. And the pattern by which these different brain structures network with each other during different tasks changes significantly as we age and mature. That's what they found.
Cool.
Right.
Makes sense.
But it's still, of course, it is still a functioning brain every step of the way. But it's interesting that kids, what that means is that kids, you know, especially very young kids, they tested down to 7 years old. They didn't test younger than seven. They think differently than adults.
They're not human.
Which it's funny to think about that because, you know, I have a 9 year old and Bob is an 11 year old, and it's funny even at 9 years old. It's interesting because in a lot of ways you can actually relate to her and you almost think of her like a little adult. But then every now and then she'll reveal that, wow, she's really thinking about things in a very different way than the way an adult would think about things. And the way they construct their world really is interestingly different. But they could fool you, you know, just conversation and whatnot. I tend to assume that it's like a little adult talking to you, but it really isn't.
Yeah, I've been reading Bruce Hood's new book, Super Sense, and hopefully we'll have him on the show soon.
I'm reading that book,
it's a very good book. Oh, what are the chances?
What are the odds?
so he discusses a lot of really interesting research that's been done on children and a lot that's been done on babies. And it's really cool to see how they test exactly how kids think. And in the case of Supersense, he's looking into how they view the supernatural world and how they process information in that way. So... And he makes the case that they do think very differently from adults. It's really interesting.
It is very interesting. So congratulations, everyone.
Why, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes,
of course, all this
well
means that number three, new research finds that attaining goals of fame, fortune, and good looks are associated with less, not more, happiness is science.
So, just give up on that.
Right. I guess that means if we did become famous skeptics and become wealthy, then we'd all be unhappy.
Really? Because I still kind of want that $1 million.
Yeah. Doesn't seem right. So these are psychological researchers which were following up on previous research that finds that people do find happiness when they set a goal for themselves and then they work to achieve that goal. That does lead to happiness, so-called self-determination.
Hard work. Definitely.
Right. But what they were saying, what they further explored with this rather long-term survey they did was, well, does it matter what kind of goals people are achieving? And what they found was that goals that essentially involve personal growth, developing close relationships, community involvement, physical health, etc., did lead to happiness. While goals that involved extrinsic things like riches or good looks or fame actually led to less happiness. And they say, well, this is the first time that question was asked, you know, separating out the kinds of goals as opposed to just seeking goals versus not seeking goals. So it's good to have goals and it's good to work towards them, but they should be ones that are fulfilling to you personally. And if you're trying to achieve this extrinsic goal or a superficial or whatever, that tends to lead to unhappiness and disappointment. Which, you know, I think kind of confirms conventional wisdom, you know.
Yeah, makes sense.
I think so, yeah.
Kind of makes certain sense, yeah. Although, yeah, I still want the $1 million.
Yeah. And we still win. Yay!
Good job, everyone. All right, Evan.
This is the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Who's that noisy?
It's time again.
Who's that noisy?
I love this time of the show. Let's play last week's Who's That Noisy?
So, of course, there's plenty of reaction to these kinds of things. There's lots of skeptical comments that basically say that there are billions of people out there with trillions of experiences, and so we hear the weird stuff. Occasionally, there's going to be an unusual coincidence, and those are the things that bubble up to the top. And so while the experience that I just read, which is a true experience, maybe it's a one in a trillion chance, but it's because there's all these other experiences that we don't hear about.
Any guesses? No?
No.
No. That's okay, because someone guessed rather quickly, and they were correct from the message board, that that is our old friend Dean Radin talking.
Dean Radin.
I don't think I'd ever heard him speak before I actually went to look him up. You know, I've certainly read some stuff that he's published and so forth. And Magnus M. from the message boards was the first one to correctly guess. So congratulations.
Congratulations.
Well done.
Dean Radin. What doesn't he believe? That's the question. That's a shorter list. You want one for this week?
Yes, Evan, please give
kind
us
kind of,
a,
yeah.
Who's that noisy for this week? I can't wait to hear.
All right. I challenge our listeners to figure out who's that noisy. All right, that's it.
I think it's what happens right before the firing squad.
The drum roll?
Yeah.
Cigarette, bandana, or blindfold. And
all right, that's interesting, Evan.
Yeah, that is, it was a good one. So see what you can come up with, and good luck, everyone.
All right, so Thomas Henry Huxley. Who doesn't know about this guy, Steve?
T.H. Huxley is one of my favorite intellectuals. Darwin's bulldog. Yeah. He essentially coined the term agnosticism to describe his own beliefs. Just an incredible, incredible intellect.
What did he say?
And were you bringing him up for a reason, or did you just want to talk about him?
Science is simply common sense at its best, that is, rigidly accurate in observation and merciless to fallacy and logic. How about that? T.H. Hux.
T.H. Hux?
Hux?
Hux to his friends.
Hux to his friends. I don't think I've ever seen a quote from T.H. Huxley that I didn't think was awesome. It's always good for a quote. Well, to celebrate our 200th episode, we are going to do a quick look back at the rogue who didn't make it to 200 with us, Perry DeAngelis. Evan put together a brief compilation of some Perry quotes, including some material that never made it to the podcast. So take a listen.
Oh, God. DNA? The double helix thing? Wait a minute. Perry got it right. Double helix. Thank you. Secretaries. Double helix. It's a helix thing. Science-ish. Remember Helix and Oscar? Two men living together? What? Sorry. Yay! Steve, you got to insert a roaring crowd there. Seriously. On the edit. Insert a roaring crowd. All right. Whatever Rosie asked from Disney, I want that. Whatever. They wouldn't give her the contract she wanted, according to her. She wanted more money. She wanted 10 mil, and they wouldn't do it. I think the final straw was that diatribe she did at that awards show. I forget the awards. So, Bob, you think that this... Yeah, good. You think that this planet is also in the vicious grip of global warming like we are? That the universe is pretty big, you know? It's pretty big. There's probably a lot of Class M planets out there. Yeah. Yeah, Ecos? It's a bad place. Well, now, wait a minute, Steve. I heard a creationist correct himself about... You know, actually, I think in the whole 6,000 year history of the Earth, I don't think a creationist has ever corrected himself about anything. I stand corrected. See? I'm willing to admit it. Thank you. It's a lot that's big about me, baby. What? Sorry. But I want to just say, I don't know about reading. I am on the cutting edge. I have a television in my bathroom. Thank you very much. So when I sit on the can, I can get absorbed into a program. I could sit there for an hour. What are you talking about? Sometimes I lounge in a tub for hours, you know, with a good movie on. But you never got a marriage proposal from me. So there you go. Thank you. All right, come on. Jay's a member. So they pickle you and then freeze you, Jay? We've thawed out another one for dinner. It's game over, man. I love them frozen babies. Excuse me. Don't talk over my jokes, please. Yeah, and you can't say George Bush is like Hitler. You can only use that for people who are actually like Hitler. Like, say, Rosie. I dare you to leave that in the podcast, Steve. I dare you to leave that in the podcast. That's cool. Yeah, let's move on. Let's just keep recording. Let's just finish this up. Let's finish this abortion up. That ought to hold the little sons of bitches till next week. Come on.
Yeah, Perry unedited was you know, indescribable.
Perry in the raw. That was only a little taste.
Yeah,
of,
seriously.
Of Perry. I wish you could have made it to 200 with us.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. These. Yes. Yep, but we're always thinking about him, and he's always part of us.
Always.
He's always part of this show. No doubt about it.
Always.
He'll always be.
I wish he was frozen.
And he's still there in the archives.
Yeah, right. Jay, if only he took your advice and froze his head, we might someday be reacquainted with him. Oh, well.
Perry's frozen head is missing. Well, thanks for that, Evan. Thanks for 200 episodes of SGU, guys.
Woohoo.
What can I say?
Wow.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of our listeners for making this the fun ride that it is.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone.
This wouldn't be nearly as much fun if there weren't people actually listening to the show.
Listening and giving us feedback.
Yeah, right.
No, and if there weren't people actually listening, then we would probably all be in a crazy hospital or something. Right. A nice padded room. They just keep talking.
Of course, it makes a difference. But, you know, to me, it's like the fact that we're doing something that has an effect is important. But, you know, I would be working at this in one way or another, I guess, no matter how successful or unsuccessful we were. But I also really love spending time with you guys. I mean, the show is fun because of you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, without a doubt, the company. It's good company.
Yeah.
I look forward to it every week.
And I think that comes across.
Yeah. Most of you guys are awesome.
Yeah.
Hey. Man, you skip out to go to one Star Trek movie.
on a Thursday.
It was the premiere.
The day before release.
Rebecca, I can't believe. The fact is, you're a total geek dork, just like the rest of us. Yeah,
I'm just mega cool about it.
You tipped your hand, everybody knows, and there's nothing bad about it. I mean,
there's no hand tipping. I know I'm a dork. I'm just the coolest dork ever.
No, I'm sorry. You have to be part geek to go to a Star Trek movie. You went and you were you're the perfect girl to be on the show with us. That's it.
I'm an ultra rad geek.
Yes, we love you.
I love you too.
As Perry would say, you're a hippie geek.
You'd call me a liberal hippie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Starving herself slowly with a vegetarian diet. That's what he'd say.
The length of my life is, what is it, inversely proportional to the quality of it?
To the torture. Like the horror.
Oh, no, that's right, the horror. The amount of years I'll live is proportional to the horror of my life.
Good stuff. Would have never been said without a podcast. So,
well, thanks again, guys.
Surely.
Thank you, Steve.
I look forward to another 200 and then some.
Here's to another 200. Absolutely. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.